hand me a towel, I'm dirty dancing by myself, gone off tabs. That acid, form me a circle, watch my Jagger.
Welcome to the New York Times Podcast, your durational performance piece of music news and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica.
We too loud in public, then police turned down a function. Now we outside and the time is perfect. Forgot to tell you, gotta tell you how much I vibe with you. And we don't gotta be solo. Now stay away from highways. My eyes like them red lights. Right now, I prefer yellow, red bone.
You're listening to Solo by Frank Ocean. Y'all mind if we wild out? I have the Dream Team here to talk about all of Frank Ocean's many projects. I have Jenna Wortham, I have Wesley Morris, I have Craig Jenkins, and I have Justin Charity. And if you don't know what a feisty roundtable this is going to be, grab a hold of your durational chair because it's about to go in. I guess the first question I want to ask everybody is for a very quick, I need a one-word answer to this first question. And we're going to start with Jenna.
Like what?
Frank Ocean releases, climax or anti-climax?
Ooh, neither, right?
Okay, that's right? A fair answer. Wesley?
I mean, it's climactic in the sense that we're talking about it. It is it's occupying a space. There's a climax, yes.
That's a sub. Okay. Craig Jenkins?
Leaning toward climax.
Also a sub. Justin?
Transcendent.
Oh, stop.
Majestic.
Yeah.
Breathtaking.
Oh, my God.
Awe-inspiring.
Is that a sub? Is that a sub of me?
No, I didn't know. That was not a sub.
The reason I asked is because, as we were just discussing before we started recording, Frank Ocean has managed to create his own mythos. He's managed to, with 4 years of basically silence, managed to put himself on a level of artists, you know, your Beyoncé's, your Kanye's, your Drake's, whereas they have typically done that with aggressive releases and consistent innovation. And so Frank has done it with disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering the degree to which what we've seen in the last 4 or 5 days has been satisfying strictly as the end of a disappearance, and to what degree it's been satisfying on its own terms. Jenna?
Okay. I'm still working through the album, and I'm really taking my time. I'm not a critic, luckily, so I don't have to know right away what I think about it. So I'm very grateful for that.
Don't worry. Most critics don't do that anyway.
You don't have to know.
All the secrets revealed in this podcast. Mm. What excites me is that we live in a time where Frank can do this. Like, I feel like this, it feels, and this is kind of what I want to know from you guys too, but it feels like a rare moment in time where an artist gets to have this much anticipation, have this much control over the release, and to be able to push out so much content at the same time. Like, I don't know, it excites me to live in a world where this very, to me, it feels like a very art schooly, which is what we were saying earlier, but like an art schooly project comes to fruition and then we get to sit and dig through it. Feels really fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's exciting.
So the abundance is part of that thrill for you.
Just the abundance and the way, you touched on this in your piece, but the way in which someone we think of as a musician gets to say, no, I'm also an essayist. No, I'm also, you know, an academic, because there's so many annotations in this entire dissertation that he's made. Like, I like that it gets to be so layered and rich.
Mm-hmm. Craig, you wrote actually 2 separate pieces. You wrote something about Endless, which was sort of the first, almost like the faint. It was like, oh, here's a thing. It's not the thing, but it's a thing. So you wrote about that, and then you wrote another piece that's about Blonde. But talk to me about your experience of it as a rollout, and did it was it a head fake for you, or did you sort of try to take it in stride?
You never know what's going on with him. I thought that the record was done last year. Like, I heard reports that it was ready last summer. So, like, you never know. But I feel like the rollout was definitely a deliberate, you know, intentional thing to be like, I'm an artist, this is my process. Wait through it, things take time, and that, like, I'm glad that we have all this stuff to work through. And it's magical sort of how much secrecy he was allowed to keep, because everyone thought there was one album coming. We didn't really know, like, who knows what else is in store, even.
Mm-hmm. I mean, time is sort of obviously something that's continually being played with here. I mean, how many of you actually sat through all 45 minutes of the visual album?
I did. I watched all of it.
I want to say that I had it on ambiently in the background while he was actually building the thing, like, at various points
over
during
the over
week.
The pre.
So, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I may have given, like, an embarrassing number of hours to it.
Mm-hmm. Wesley, when you were sitting there watching it, did you glean something from minute 35 that maybe you didn't glean from minute 5?
No, but I'm into process I mean, you know, I've spent an inordinate amount of time in my life watching European movies. And you
I thought you were going to say watching carpentry videos.
I mean,
which
but
actually
a lot of them are
fire.
Carpentry videos. Do you know what I mean? Have you seen Tarkovsky?
True.
You know, this is not Tarkovsky, but I'm just saying, like
you,
my threshold of tolerance for people not quote not doing anything or for narrative. I don't need a narrative. Who knows what's going to happen in this thing? Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to sort of see it bear out. But I knew what the punchline was, I knew what he was building before I started to watch it.
You did, like you knew because you
someone told me.
Oh, okay.
So it's like, oh, all that for what you get. But even that didn't bother me that much. I mean, I enjoyed. There were things about it, and I guess one of the things that struck me was, and we can talk about this in a different way, but there is this kind of naive discovery of stuff. That wearing of the Jesus and Mary chain shirt for me mm-hmm. was the kind of thing that when I was, what would I have been in 1992 or 93? Like when I was like a teenager, I would have gotten beaten up for wearing that shirt to school. But in 2016, you know, a black kid can wear a Jesus and Mary chain shirt and there's like, there may or may not be quotation marks, but you know, I would like to say that like, I died for Frank Ocean to be able to wear that shirt in 2016. So I felt like some progress had definitely been made. I felt like what I was watching was like a kid in class do a senior project with like self-assistance.
But there's also a bit of, I don't want to say a talking to or a sternness about it, but there is a little bit of the first thing you're going to see from my comeback is just how hard I've been working.
Right.
Like there is a little bit of like, oh, y'all going to be out here talking about how I don't make records and I don't put stuff out and I don't release me. That's what you're talking about. Okay, good. I'm going to make a staircase. You're going to watch it too.
John.
Like that's, there was something a little bit like tisk tisky underneath that. I felt,
I think, but I, you know, when the live stream of the carpentry video first went up, you know, I feel like people immediately started hitting Frank Ocean with the, okay, but seriously, where's the music? Where's the music? And I think the thing I didn't really, it was like the first thing in all of this that I wrote for The Ringer was like, guys, I kind of don't, I get that you love Frank Ocean, but Apple Music is paying him to do this convoluted carpentry video. Like, I'm pretty sure that this is going to be a thing that once it's over and once we're on the other side of it, it feels like you're about to get music and you're about to get a lot of content, hashtag content, that is going to make the wait for this seem pretty trivial in the same way that in retrospect, the wait for Anti seemed pretty trivial. Mm-hmm. The wait for Black Messiah, even to me, seems kind of like, okay, it was pretty worth it.
Mm-hmm. But the question for me is, I was not an Apple Music subscriber before this video dropped.
Do you have to be one to get it? Or just buy it on iTunes, right?
No. To see Endless, you have to be an Apple Music
subscriber. This is why I haven't seen it. Okay.
That, to me, was... I was like, this can't continue. Well, now it doesn't have to continue because I guess I'm keeping my Apple membership, my free trial, which I'm going to forget to stop when it's
over. Of course.
That's how they get you.
But, mm-hmm. you know, I did this. And now Spotify, of course, is going to try to get me back by, like, mm-hmm. the new Shock Adele record is going to open. Or, like, drop, and, like, I got to go back to Spotify. Because she's the only person. Who else is left at this point who could make you spend, you know, subscribe monthly to a streaming service?
In
Adele wants to push those units. Remember, she didn't put the 25 on them.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Who among the
top? Well, and at this point, most they're all signed to Apple, pretty much. You have your drinks.
Right.
You have Kanye's idol.
And until this record, Frank Ocean was not at the tippity top of... It wasn't like that.
Tell me about the ability for one to create their own mythology, especially in the age of the internet. Because I think so many people use the internet in a proactive way to create their mythology. They're writing themselves into an elevated self or an elevated perspective version of themselves. But Frank did the opposite. He basically created a vacuum. And especially given how intense and kind of hyper-referential online discourse is, Frank's refusenik approach to that is actually maybe the most radical act of invention. Jenny,
you're looking at me.
I'm looking at you.
Well, I keep thinking about this idea that, you know, a few years ago there was so much lamenting over the ways in which the internet had ruined our appetite for good music or like rich music or you know, we only wanted tiny bites. The we had no attention spans. We had no, kind of comparing that to where we are right now, which is there's this other environment created where the companies that own these music streaming sites are in such heavily and such heavy competition with each other that the only way to get people to sign up for Apple Music or right. iTunes or Spotify and eventually SoundCloud, right, is to engender this kind of mythology that will make you end up signing up and forgetting to unsubscribe and whatever. So I think I'm really interested in the weird cyclicalness of kind of the way way that sort of the internet has refostered the environment for event pop or like a big album
demanding
art piece
to be a water cooler.
So yeah, I think that's why we're here in to some degree, and these companies have so much money.
And this and basically what you're saying the next logical step is, in essence, these companies, your Apples, your Spotify's, your Tidals, have to partner with creatively rich, ambitious, complicated artists. Because if they're partnering with flashes in the pan or people who come and go very quickly, you're not incentivized to sign up for them at $9.99 a month. But if you think that you might get 3 to 5 Frank or Frank equivalents over the course of the year, then that
it's
justifies
worthwhile,
right.
To some degree.
And so this intersection of sort of, you know, not to be lame and 90s about it, but this intersection of corporate interests and aesthetic interests of an artist is actually something that this system fosters.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine Tower Music being like, Madonna, only place to get Madonna is right up in here. Like, Michael Jackson signed an exclusive deal with Sam Goody.
That didn't happen?
No. Not to that. Well,
because there were so many.
Are you
there
sure?
I don't know about the secret Prince Coconuts deal, but I'm pretty sure that didn't happen.
Well,
and there were no there's no mom and pop shop to get digital music. I mean,
Bandcamp,
it's free.
Bandcamp.
Well,
okay, but not digital, not Superstar Digital. But what about Target or Walmart offering exclusive versions Superstar?
Yeah, but that's a belch before this. Whatever this is.
Death right. of the CD era kind of like flailing.
Right. Mm-hmm. That seemed more, I mean, I guess there's I'm feeling cynical about it, but I don't know that I necessarily believe my cynicism. All I'm saying is I watched Endless, and by the time, you know, you have this great bookend, by the way, which we should also talk about, this great sort of like musical bookend that basically is sort of making extra meta what was already meta about the creative process, and you know, the devices are here. Like, you know, Apple is a place where you can live your life, or like any sort of like physical electronic device is now where we all live, and it's the organizing principle of all our lives. And here we are at Apple, just having signed up, watching Frank Ocean make what he's going to make. I won't ruin it for anybody who hasn't watched it. But
oh, I think we can spoil.
I don't think it's. I don't know. I am so.
I'm just going to do it.
Don't. Why?
But does he actually build the staircase at the end? Because if he does, then I'll sign up.
Oh my God,
then
guys, I'll watch so it. Saying, what the F?
Then I will watch it. Because I think it's not. I don't even know. I don't care. I don't think. I'm here
Lawful
for the process.
Good.
Like, I'm.
Anarchic good. What was that?
That was dope, Jetta.
That was awesome.
Does he build answer! Does he build a thing?
That was my question like 2 weeks ago.
It was
like,
so much better than anything I was going to do. It was like, that was beyond.
I just don't think we can talk about the myth, like this sort of larger than life thing that Frank is doing without acknowledging that there are very real commercial interests in it. And I think that's totally separate from the question of, was it worth the hype? Was it worth the hate, the weight that people have? I feel like that's the conversation people are getting into now, right? But like, which interests me a lot less than just sort of the incentives behind, you know, trying to elevate someone like Frank to the point where they can be number one for X number of weeks. Like, I think that, you know, like.
But I still think I struggle with the question that you started with at the top, which is, how did those commercial interests identify Frank? And how did Frank get to that place where earlier we were making him the Madonna or the Prince in this situation?
And just, I think it's worth before, because I want to, that's exactly where I want to go. But let's talk a little bit about what Frank has done up until this point, up until 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago. Frank has a mixtape, which is called Nostalgia Ultra, which is 2011. And very well received and sort of musically expansive. And he was a songwriter prior to that, not a particularly successful songwriter, but but a songwriter nonetheless. Then came Channel Orange, which is his major label debut, with which has one sort of very indelible pop-oriented hit, which is called Thinking About You, but is also a bit of a spacious, you know, kind of low-key but spacious album. And
John, it's just perfect, and there are
vibes, man.
Eight
vibes.
Or nine just amazing songs on that record. Just period.
It's a very good record, but it is also, if we're talking about Frank in the same breath as we're talking about Kanye or Beyonce or whatever,
yes,
it is a low-key record. Frank is a low-key artist.
Yeah, it isn't. There's nothing explosive about it or incendiary.
No, I mean, but in tone, you know, it's weirdly, I would say, closer to a Maxwell than to it, as far as the gentleness.
It's like a Bilal record to me. Like that.
It is Channel Orange. Yes, I totally like that.
I love Bilal. That's a compliment.
That's what I mean when I say I'm surprised by the scale, like the scalability of Frank Ocean. Because to me, it's like,
no, this,
he's a guy who made two hit records when Mitt Romney was running for president. And like he cuts to the head of the line and becomes Beyonce. And I just can't get the.
Well, you also have to consider the moment, because 2011 was, you know, painted out to be this huge sort of like revolutionary time for R&B and stuff, and you had other guys that were, you know, jumping out there, like The Weeknd and all those people. So like, I mean, he benefited from this sort of like upwind, like,
but that was
esteem.
A lie. Like, we all know that was a lie. Right, yeah. Like, can we just say that right now?
That part of why he got up there is like there was an updraft when he flew out, and like, you know, the record did decently, but it's all critical sort of cachet. Like.
But also, you know, we have to talk about Frank Ocean as an individual outside of the context of music. What did Frank do right when he dropped Channel Orange? Frank went on Tumblr and announced that I don't know if it was the first person he ever been in love with, but then when he was 19 years old, he fell in love with a man.
Right.
And that was something that was caught a lot of people off guard. And I think when we're talking about someone's public persona, who's a musician primarily, that was a thing that exponentially grew the conversation around Frank.
Mm-hmm.
And I think forced people to take him seriously as something more than an album artist, or rather an artist who makes albums. That was
the extent
of the conversation.
He was given social hero status in some ways for just being a black male in the hip hop R&B sphere who was openly whatever queer. He was he queered himself.
Mm-hmm.
He came out as queer. That's a huge part of what the desperation was in the 4 years that he was, quote, not doing anything, unquote. I feel for him in a lot of ways, but also what happened in his wake. I mean, there are a lot of artists. They aren't all in the pop sphere. Well, they are actually, but they're just doing different things than Frank's doing. I think there are a lot of just...
You mean musically?
Musically, In those 4 years, I think things have gotten normal in a lot of ways, but abnormal, not normal enough in others.
Mm-hmm. Would these things that you're talking about, these artists that you're talking about, do you think that progress or development would have happened if Frank had not done what he did?
I think that's a cultural thing that he is a part of, but I don't think he caused it. I think it's just a normalization of a lot of experiences, and I think that the channels to be able to express yourself, it's just easier.
Mm-hmm.
There are fewer barriers. There's no label that's going to stop, you know, half the people I'm thinking about from recording these records, because none of them are major label artists anyway.
It was kind of a right place, right time, right record situation. Mm-hmm. You know,
like Young M.A.
Oh my goodness. Oh my, John.
That's an excellent point.
That is right record, right time.
It's just like in the history of like that particular genre and the history of the listenership, it was kind of hard to be an artist who was any kind of out. But just the times had changed a little bit by 2012, and there was actually like some steam and some, you know, antagonism of like homophobia and, you know, the culture writ large. And so Frank walks in and he's like, well, guess what? Like, and, you know, he already has this growing fandom, and he already has the ear of, like, you know, Beyonce and Jay-Z and Kanye West. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, get on board or don't kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
The thing that I love about Channel Orange is that so much of it is, I understand what that person is experiencing. I mean, at least on the first three or four or five tracks. And they are about a person arriving at a world that is new to him mm-hmm. and being utterly fascinated by it and wanting to be a part of it. And a lot of those songs are about the discovery that there's another, there's like the Huxtables are real. The Bankses of Bel Air are mm-hmm. real. He loves that. And there's, I think that there's, I mean, even Forrest Gump, which is at the end of that record, is about these new feelings and these new experiences. And that newness is all over that record. Mm-hmm. And sonically, it doesn't sound like anything, doesn't sound derivative at all to me. The thing that I'm, that strikes me about this new record is
about Blonde specifically.
About Blonde, yes, mm-hmm. is that he is on the other side of the looking glass now.
Yep.
He does not know what to make of that. You know, the songwriting is ambiguous.
He's
structurally ambiguous and lyrically too. Mm-hmm. Channel Orange is so clear in its storytelling and its sort of like mm-hmm. psychological reckoning with space and self and feeling. The reckoning here is entirely with Frank Ocean's persona. Like, who does he want to be? I don't know. Like, and I don't know what it's like to be so wanted and desired mm-hmm. by people I don't know.
But what's striking to me about the lyrics on Blonde, especially, and Endless and Blonde are a little bit different, but I think Blonde is, if we're going to talk about lyrics, is probably the richer text to
yes.
get into.
Yes. So well, the one I was paying more attention yeah. to because...
Well, because there was no...
There was wood being worked.
Yeah, right. There is a tremendous amount of loneliness and letdown on Blonde, I find. And this thing that you're talking about where on Channel Orange, it's so much about eye-opening and dipping your toes into something and saying, oh, I have access to this world. Blonde really feels about all the ways in which that world has let him down and, mm-hmm. and disappointed him and proven to be false in a lot of ways in terms of depths of emotional connection, romantic connection, and potential happiness. It's interesting. A lot of the music on Blonde to me feels there's like almost like a moistness to it. It feels there's a freshness to it. Mm-hmm. But when he's singing, I feel like he's singing about someone who doesn't do right by him and then he kind of trails off. And he's kind of like, I don't even know if I can give this time. Like, I'm just like,
right. There are a lot of unpacked ideas, incomplete thoughts, songs that just kind of end before. But I don't. I mean, can you? I mean, you guys want to talk about this as an aesthetic strategy? How I feel is, I got music when I wanted songs, you know, or I wanted songs with my music.
But it is. It feels like more of a mood piece, whereas mm-hmm, Channel Orange mm-hmm. felt like a songwriter, someone who. Whose primary occupation was to create songs.
See, I think that about Channel Orange. I think that it was kind of really like there was a lot of vignettes in there. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is more like a deliberate kind of we're stitching these together into a picture kind of a thing uh-huh. than that was. I think of the Todd Rundgren sample that's in that solo, but, mm-hmm. you know, from the record A Wizard, A True Star, which is sort of like this really like long record of just these 1 and 2 minute songs that kind of hang together and you get an idea out of thundering through them. And so that's like what I get out of the, you know, sort of shorter, weirder portions of Blonde right now. Mm.
Same with Endless?
Endless, I really feel like it's just a tape of bass freestyle. That's what I was
yeah.
saying.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
just like just like a lot of trash talking, like maybe some of the ideas of Blonde coming together and sort of not being fleshed out.
Should we listen to something off Endless?
Comme des Garçons.
Let's listen to Comme des Garçons.
He came up in Dallas, had no hazel in his eyes, had them sailors on his thighs, but his lady shone, captivated on the side. We were seeing someone, we was dating on the side, he was seeing double. I was spinning hula, we were spending so much time, it was getting cooler. All this drilling got the good, feeling like a power tool. And I'm over, I get out of my house, now that's a power move. That's what I gotta do for real. With that diamond shine.
So that was Comme des Garçons from Endless, the visual album by Frank Ocean that came out last week. I'm still here with Justin Charity, Craig Jenkins, Wesley Morris, and Jenna Wortham. Justin, now's as good a time as any to read something that you wrote. I didn't save quotes from everybody's writing, but I did save this one from Justin, who wrote about one track on Endless. I'm going to smile the whole way through this. Frank Ocean makes sedate, pretentious, selection auteur, post-peak prestige cable TV drama. Homie took Garden State a little too seriously, a decade too late. Overpriced coffee table book music.
And ooh. I stand by it, and I guarantee it. No, well, here's the thing. So I wrote that. I wrote that about.
That's your based freestyle, just for the
bars.
Seriously.
So I wrote that about a song off of Endless, and it's funny. After I was like going back and listening to Channel Orange after I listened to Endless, and I am a Channel Orange detractor. Mm-hmm. And I went back and listened to Channel Orange, and I started to appreciate that I don't like a lot of the mood and aesthetic, and I don't like a lot of the very, what feels like new bougie songwriting of Channel Orange. Mm-hmm. But Endless mm-hmm. and even Blonde make me appreciate that Channel Orange is an album of songs and a guy singing. And I just feel like everything from Nostalgia Ultra through Blonde is me getting less and less out of this guy, to the point that Blonde to me, you know, Blonde sounds very different from Endless, and I'd still apply that sentence you just read to Blonde, where it's like Quentin Miller reference tracks a little bit. It's like you get eight really solid bars of like, okay, we're going somewhere, and then it's just like, oh, 10 bands, 20 bands.
If you think you're not getting primo content on podcast this week, you're paying attention.
Okay, but let me ask you a question, though. Like, why do there have to be fully realized songs?
Yeah.
It's not even about the fully realized. It's like, I just think his writing degrades with every project. The song structures degrade with every project. There's less drums with every project.
That's what I like about
it. There's less bass lines right. with every project. Uh-huh. And it's just like we're getting the thing that reduces to is just a form of music that I'm kind of not interested in. It's campfire music. It's bougie drug angst campfire music.
Okay,
and
but
But
here's an important question, right? And this ties back to what we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, which is so much of the corporate structure of these event releases is wrapped up in basically, does the artist have enough of a mythology in order to justify this kind of event release? The sort of turnaround of that is you have artists who are using event releases for increasingly complex or unusual things. Like, let's say Beyoncé is kind of like the baseline, and it's like it's video and it's audio. It's intense, but it's very, very tightly structured, and it's very, very sort of militaristic and rollout. Then you have Kanye, and Kanye's like, yeah, it's out, but it's like not really out because like I want to get your attention, but then I'm going to change it and I'm going to mess with it. And then Frank is like, well, it's sort of rolling out at a pace that like no one's really comfortable with, really. But on top of that, it's not really an album. It's not really a video piece. It's also a magazine that you kind of can't get unless you stood on a street corner in New York or Los Angeles. And so it's interesting that the thing that you're responding to, Justin, when you're saying, oh, he's degraded the album, I think you can actually have the counterpoint and say, actually, he's inserted a level of ambition and strangeness into what we have now learned to expect should be a very straightforward, sudden drop.
I guess, but musically, it just feels like it's possible to overstate the sort of weirdness of Frank's music, especially like I think Endless is weird, but I don't know. I just listened to Blonde and I'm like, it seems like indie music by committee. It seems like a lot of pitchfork core synths and no hooks. And it's just like, I feel like the pop vulgarian here being like...
No, it's crazy. I think there's...
pitchfork core synths with no hooks. Where are the
it's
hooks?
It's strange. Because I've now listened to Blonde like 5 or 6 times. And I listened to it on the way... Right, but I listened to it on the way here today. And I'd sort of, somewhere in those first 4 or 5 listens, had lost the hooks mentally. I was like, ah, maybe it is as abstract and floaty as people are saying it is. And then on the train here today, I was like, oh, no, they're hooks. They're just not prioritized. That's actually what's interesting is I think if you were literally looking at hooks and the hooks and melody on paper, they're there. Right. But it's not unlike on Channel Orange where, like Wesley, you were saying before, it's like these are a capital S songs. Yeah. Here it's like, oh, I threw in a hook, but then it faded.
Solo is like that. Solo is my favorite song off of Blonde. But that's like a good example where I think he pulls it off, where that song technically has a hook. But it's not a pop record. It feels very much like a riff, and you just sort of go with it.
My favorite song on the record right now is Nights, and it takes like 3 minutes to get to it, like an identifiable hook. But then for like 2 minutes, it just like rides like in hook mode, and it's just like maybe it doesn't structurally have to go verse, chorus, verse. chorus, repeat, you know, bridge, whatever, and then close out and start it over again. Like, and I like that he's doing weird structural stuff with it because mm-hmm. you lean in and you have to listen closer.
But my only thing is you make that sound unambitious. You make the idea of structure sound like that per se means boredom and a lack of ambition. And it's like Radiohead has hooks, dog.
It's not that structure is unambitious. It's that there are two ways to go about it. And I don't think that him not going about it the way that everyone expects him to is necessarily a knock against it.
Mm-hmm. See, I feel like the music is the least interesting thing to me about the album right now. Like, the degrees of difficulty that Frank is putting people through, like, you had to, like, Wesley was telling me that he walked by Mulberry Iconic magazines and didn't know that the Frank, you know, like, this, you had to have such a level of fluency and knowledge to even be on board to get the zine, to get the album, to realize that Endless was its own thing, to, like, and that is sort of, I feel like, the most informative thing about what Frank is trying to do right now, which is, like, he's here for us, but we have to work so damn hard for it. And I actually really respect that. But I also feel like it's all a distraction from two things. One, it's like we're dealing with a level of interiority of, you know, someone who is openly like doesn't want to be called straight or really even gay, but bent. You know, that's how he describes mm-hmm. himself. So we have this buffet of an interior life of a queer black teenager living in America that is the richest thing that we've had in I don't even know how many years. Like, I don't know anything that's been that mainstream and that atypical, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we just don't get that. And I'm biased because that's probably the last thing I'm interested in. Like, give me Young MA or give me, like, any woman to talk about being young and black and queer and a teenager, mm-hmm. and I'm, like, 100% for it. So I'm very biased because I'm sort of like, oh, really, Frank? Go on, tell me more. You want to be blonde? You see yourself as a woman? Really? You know, like, I just feel like we're not, like, and he's not. The other thing that kind of frustrates me is, like, we haven't dealt with that Tumblr text where he's like, I saw a picture of a girl. He wants to be a blonde woman. He's like trying to imagine his life inside of another of a blonde white woman. Like, what? Like, I want to talk about that. And nothing about Nike, the video, deals with that for me in a way that I find satisfactory, even though Frank doesn't have to satisfy me. And I'm like coming to terms with that. And that's OK. But I also just feel like there's this very half-inness about the album that I can't quite get my head around, at least with Channel Orange. I felt like these emotions are recognizable. Like, I understand kind of what you're trying to work through. And I'm mm-hmm. even if his voice is weird or the songs are weird, like, whatever. I was very mm-hmm. much like, this feels so resplendent that I want to engage and but I don't feel that with Blonde. And I'm still getting my feet wet, and it takes me a very long time to get into music, I have to say. So,
but is part of that maybe because Frank himself isn't, he himself doesn't necessarily have the firmest read, no pun intended,
yeah.
but the firmest read on his okay. own. Because a thing that struck me, and we talked a little bit before we started recording about the singing or lack thereof on this record, a thing that really strikes me on this record is the number of different voices he's trying out in any mm-hmm. on any given song. I feel like we're moving between two and three voices, different types of singing, rapping, spoken word, etc.
Distortion.
I mean, there's like Prince shrieks on the end of one song. He's really all over the place.
Yeah, artistically, like, that's great. I mean, like, I love a Kanye scream. Like, I love when you hear something really unexpected and strange and new. I think that's really fun too. But I don't know. I'm sort of like struggling with this, like, I don't know. Frank's like, I'm just struggling with the lack of cohesiveness about it.
But I'm saying, could it be that he's trying out voices? Like, quite literally trying voices out.
The mean person who lives inside me says that this reminds me of a few years ago when, like, anyone who was funny on Twitter got, like, a TV deal. Or, like, that's what it feels like to me a little bit. But I also think, the thing is, I actually think Frank is incredible, and I'm really excited. Like, that, I really want to live in a world where he gets to make this piece, and it doesn't have to be perfect.
Yeah, but he did. You know what? The funny thing is, he did it, right? Like, that's, I mean, yeah. this has been pulled off. I think the thing that we are all frustrated when 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago it didn't happen. And I think the culture was having the pitchforks people were mad. And, you know, you and I, Jenna, have discussed the ethics of being mad at somebody for not giving you something
on your schedule.
Right. But, right. I mean, he owes us nothing.
But I don't think, and, you know, I had this whole psychic read about, like, what's the holdup? He's not ready to deal with the, like, all of what we're doing right now. But now that we have all this stuff, I just think a boat just didn't come into the dock on time and they couldn't mm-hmm. figure out where to put the magazines.
I think,
like,
that's
what's
right.
a good venue to put all this stuff. Mm-hmm. I think it was just logistical. That was the holdup.
Which is less romantic.
less romantic, but it also makes more sense.
Of course.
Like, it just did this, like, that you couldn't figure out where to have the pop-up shop or your first choice didn't come through makes more sense to me than
this, like, angst or, like,
I
torment.
Really want
to
have this,
I mean, there's, like, Beatles interpolations in there that cannot be easy to pull off.
Right.
Yeah, but also, like, this is why, you know, the overlap, we haven't really talked very much about the magazine itself, but the overlap of the magazine and the album is interesting because there is a version, quote unquote, of the album that's theoretically pegged to the magazine. But what I think that is that magazine went to print 4 months ago or six months ago, and that probably was what the album sounded like or what the track listing was when the album, and then it changed in the last. I mean, I bumped into a guy a couple weeks ago. I was like, oh, you know, Frank Ocean, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, oh, yeah, he's at the Mercer. He's working on songs right now. And I was like, really? What? Come on, man. Like, seriously? And also some of the logistics stuff, there aren't really very many actual differences between the physical CD that came with the magazine and the digital version that ends up on iTunes. But there is a different version of Nikes that is on the physical CD.
Mm-hmm.
Ko and Luda, who are two Japanese rappers who got attention on Itchy Ma, which is the Keith Ape record from a couple years ago, they are on the version that's in there. And maybe they couldn't get cleared for the digital. Like, who
there's
knows
lyrics for songs that aren't there also. But
right, because one of them sort of ends up on Endless, it seems like.
Oh, yeah, the
right, and one of them is in the ether. Who knows? I do think what you're saying is right, that these are logistical foibles. But it goes back to Frank's ability to kind of navigate this kind of overlap of, like, I'm a representative of Apple. Like, you know, I'm using Apple Music to my benefit, but I also, like, want to have this, like, very unusual project that doesn't necessarily foreground one particular approach to being Frank Ocean.
Yeah.
I just think back to when Kanye put the Madison Square Garden show on, and he only played you 10 of the songs that ended up being like a, what, 17 song record?
Mm-hmm.
It's just the logistics of pulling off something that massive, you know, are kind of tricky. And so we didn't even get the album until nearly a week later. And I don't know, I think of this Frank Ocean run as being like, all right, this guy's got to not only roll out himself building a staircase, but he's got to get all this stuff in here. He's got to make sure the record is done. He's got to make sure the magazine's done. He's got to make sure there's somewhere to put it. And so, I mean, like, always knowing that there are like a couple of moving parts that we didn't like necessarily have on point, on deck. You know, in the process, I was never really like shocked. I always knew that there was something going to come out of the end of the pipeline of it.
Mm-hmm.
Just like what all it was ended up being the mystery.
How many of you guys have actually had a chance to look through the whole magazine?
There's a PDF of the first 127 pages, but the juicy stuff's after it, like the list of songs and movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know I haven't because
I'm
texting you.
I'm sorry.
Send me. I'm most interested in the magazine because I really am. I mean, I heard that there were like browser histories like that.
Yeah.
To me, I want it. That's like I'm so interested in the.
You
want to
see people's browser histories?
I do.
These are interesting. Yeah.
There's like a 5-page interview with Lil B in there.
There's something fascinating. And I love Brandon. Like that's to me. I'm like okay. That to me feels a little bit more authentic in terms of like this sort of you know Frank is very much a product of Tumblr, but he's also a product of the way people pattern match with like. You know, ideas and artists and color. Like that's what I'm interested in because I feel like that's like the stuff I want to see.
It's a packaged mood board.
Yep.
That's
me.
What I want.
No, and this is where the Tumblr thing comes in. Right. I mean, you know, it's from a distance, that magazine looks a lot like, you know, Oyster Magazine or any of these sort of like $40 fashion publications that you'd buy at you know, a higher end magazine stand. But it's very clear that he has thematic through lines. Like he's incredibly interested in nudes. He's incredibly interested in
men
automobiles. Yeah, men and women. Automobiles and sort of the intersection. I think his versions of eroticism are very, very tied up in cars. And that's something that I wish he actually kind of maybe got into more on the record. But it's very much a through line of the magazine. But I was really moved by the browser histories. It's not just his. There's like a few different people's browser
histories.
Someone's
got like the Bieber nude up. In the first couple pages.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple. I mean, there. Yeah. I mean, it's
bon Jovi,
like very referential. There's,
like a,
there's a couple.
Oh, I don't remember
well-known.
The Bon. Was there a Bon Jovi thing?
I mean,
there are some well-known Tumblr artists though who make Tumblr is very dated. They're really more like Instagram. There are a lot of Instagram artists who make work out of their own and other people's browser histories. So even that, it's that aesthetic to me is really interesting. This idea of what constitutes an identity, what constitutes a life, like what we're hiding, what we're willing to present to people and what we're actually thinking. So like that duality of, and those things are more interesting to me.
And do you, to sort of wrap up that idea, like you look at Blonde and it's spelled two different ways. And obviously the reason, you know, the masculine and the feminine, but how does that feel to you when you're reading it? Also, shout out to everybody we know who said it was a copy editing mistake on Twitter.
Really? So great.
Shout out to
everyone's like,
people.
No, it's wrong. No, it's
yeah.
It's
shout
PPE.
Out to I was stupefied by how many people said that. But what was the takeaway from that? Jenny, you were mentioning sort of Frank wanting to be a blonde white woman, maybe, or like.
Oh yeah, let's get back to that.
At least, well, I want to know what you guys think. I mean, at least, sort of trying to implicate that was sort of a starting point and for something for him in thinking through like what he was trying to relay or like maybe his identity to gayness. I don't know.
I was struck by on Channel Orange. I mean, Forrest Gump is just—it's a great song, and it's the last song on that record. I think I'm pretty sure it's not. If it's not the last song, it's the second to last song. The idea that you would sort of build this crush around what culturally or iconographically is like just a white football player, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we're talking about Forrest Gump, he's also stupid. But
special needs. come on now.
But, no, the Forrest Gump is just about the running.
Right. But
that's a great song.
But whatever we're supposed to think of this guy is, I, in my appreciation of that song, whether it's metaphorical or literal, am envisioning white, like a black person having desire for a white person.
Right.
And there's an interracial dimension to that. That I mean, I think his interest in whiteness,
white culture, and, rich well, kids. I mean,
yeah, like or in the spectrum of American culture. That was the. I mean, that person was me when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. I liked everything. I wanted to listen to everything. I wanted to watch everything. I wanted to be friends with everybody. Mm-hmm. It's just interesting to watch a person sort of build an identity around what in 2016 still feels like a new idea, mm-hmm. right? The idea that your blackness is not confined to black culture. And you can be a black person who can absorb Jesus and Mary Chain. Or I think there's a lot of Arthur Russell in this record. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of Arthur Russell ideas in this record.
Arthur
Radiohead.
Lee.
Huh?
Arthur Lee, is it?
Yeah,
maybe
I mean,
what do you
mean when you say that it still feels new? Because that's the thing. I don't.
I think what's new about it is I can't think of another major artist who this explicitly, but without this much pronouncement. I just feel like the explicit white culture, white music. I mean, he's putting this forward.
Well, here's a game. Like it always people always existed that like, you know, were like look at a Donald Glover say. Like there's always sure. people, you know, who grew up in the hood and you got made fun of because you like different stuff.
Right.
And what's happened now is that a lot of us have just kept quiet long enough in order to get a platform. And so something that has existed all along, we're now able to shine us.
I'm not
on.
Saying it's culturally
yeah,
new.
Well,
I'm saying the presentation
like,
of it.
Yeah.
I'm saying I mean, just starting with me as a kid in the 80s, I'm sure you can, I'm sure there are kids in, like, every
relate.
Kid in every
relate.
Decade has had this experience.
Yeah, of course.
I think, but he is one of the few people I can think of where the identity is both conspicuous and yet uninflected, right? It's not like Living Color for me, which was also mind blowing, where, you know, they were black guys doing rock music according to the people who accepted and then regurgitated what they were doing back to us.
Well, the difference now is just you can see the process. Like, we couldn't see the thought process behind it before. And this is like, Frank Project is just like a big, like, sort of like mind vomit where we can see like all the stuff that visually interests him, the stuff that he writes about, the stuff that he's thinking about, the stuff that he likes musically and all that. And just like, what makes it seem brand new is that just no one has ever opened up their entire brain like that.
I always thought that Kanye was the ultimate listens to Daft Punk once guy, or the guy
Simples
who's like
can, loves Akira.
But yeah, and that's the thing. Like, to me, and maybe that's why I feel more exasperated with Frank's version of it. Because to me, I associate
fair.
Like the past 5 years or more of Kanye with being like, you know, I'm going to beg Anna Wintour to pay attention to me and like beg white people for money and radio.
And also,
and it's just like,
so this
how
is
old
what
is
I'm
Frank?
Saying though, that
28.
So that makes sense. I mean, that's
he's
this
10
is,
years younger,
yeah, like,
11
but
years younger
towing
than
the line with that binary and the sort of defiance around identity politics. Like, I am actually not going to let you categorize me as this or this or this or this. And like, I've grown up on the fringes of all of these cultures mm-hmm. and subcultures that aren't actually subcultures to my peers. I think that actually, seen through that lens, it makes a lot more sense. Like, he's the defiance to sort of say, like, I identify, you know what I mean? Like, I am
I'm all of this stuff.
Right, but also,
we are all of this stuff.
But also, I'm none of these.
I'm none of these.
This is a thing. Like, this is a record, Blonde especially, this is a record about not belonging. Like, this is not a record about I found 10 different homes or 30 different homes. This is a record about I found 10 or 30 different homes and none of them felt right. This is a record about I met a guy, he took me to this gay bar, and actually, this guy's no good.
Fooled around on his phone the whole time.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
how do you miss a date with Frank Ocean?
Yeah, like, seriously, who's that guy?
It sounds like there's three or four of them on the record too. It doesn't sound like the same one.
Listen, listen. Can I just
Los Angeles,
talk to you guys,
please?
Go ahead.
This is the other thing about the Frank Ocean experience, which is that it's not the Frank Ocean experience. It's the gay black male experience. It is the experience, and I'm sure he's trafficking in white gayness because. When you're in LA, I mean, it's just much easier to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I won't say more, but I get it. Well, I understand like whatever city he's in, but especially if he's in Los Angeles.
What's that YouTube video? It's like you're cute for a black guy on Grindr. Yeah, oh, like, God, Google that, and that's like, you know, it makes a lot of sense in that context.
No, I mean,
just my preference, no black, no, you know.
And look, he might be Frank Ocean, but he's Frank Ocean to us. Like, in West Hollywood, he's a black dude. You know, I mean, it just is.
I did hear a story about someone going to a Halloween party and Frank Ocean was there, and like, it wasn't, and no one talked to him. It's not like they didn't want to make him uncomfortable, because people in Hollywood, they're used to celebrity and they cultivate it and they know how to ignore it and like kind of cater to it. And they were just like, Frank looks so despondent and sad. It was just a downer. Like, it wasn't like, let's give him his privacy. It was more just like, we actually can engage with him because he's so depressed seeming at this party, and like, no one wanted to deal with that emotion.
Got dumped.
Yeah,
in fairness,
I think that's kind of funny.
Musically, though, the question of Frank Ocean and belonging, I think, to me, just like as a listener, seems strange, because my sort of, again, vulgarian take is just that Frank Ocean went from being, like, in my mind, right, a guy who's making very strong R&B records to being a guy who seems like he's ashamed of R&B music in a way and is making Duran Duran records.
Right? Yeah, but this is, and Craig, we were talking a little bit about this earlier, this conversation about whether Blonde is an R&B record or whether Frank Ocean is an R&B artist, like, this all feels like a weird wash to me, but I'm curious, like, why do you think that it's activated so many conversations like that? Because when I listened to this record, I didn't feel, I mean, maybe, you know, that's just years of criticism and I don't bother with stuff like that very much. But like, why do you think that it activated? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. True. True. Why does it have people talking like that? What anxiety does it induce in listeners that's bringing that up?
I don't know. All I know is that one song in, I lost any idea that it was going to be, like, per se an R&B record. But I just think that, like, I came up in an era where there was, like, Prince and Michael Jackson and Janet Jackson running around. And so I always had this idea that, you know, black artists can do any solitary thing. But there's just a lot of, in the last sort of couple of years of, you know, black music in general, been this sort of really closed-minded idea of things. You know, even within, like, subgenres and stuff, like in rap, there's, you know, people who hate the trap kids, and there's people who hate, you know, the older rap and stuff. And so it's just like the weird stratification of the you know, hip-hop scene is kind of creating this anger about this thing not being what it doesn't have to be.
But it also, it is destabilizing, when you talk about, like, scenes that destabilize straightforward notions, black identity or black identity is expressed through genre. It's strange how many people have been unsettled by Frank Ocean, who has been a destabilizing force for 5 years
already. You mean because they don't know how to classify it?
Yeah.
As though there had previously not been. I mean, I was thinking about this when, like, just thinking about Janet Jackson.
Yep.
And one of the things that you and I kind of didn't really talk about when we talked about her a couple weeks ago that is really true, and you can take for, I mean, like, forget Janet Jackson. En Vogue.
Yes.
En Vogue. En Vogue had modes. They did different stuff, and nobody batted an eye.
Yeah.
No, it was just, it was not like,
but
I mean,
categorizing is a way that we deal with, like, a glut of things to be like, how do I think about this? Like, what do I do with this album?
The limiting, I feel like we're now, like, I don't know why, we've re-entered this place in the last couple of years where we have to, we're doubling down on our blackness. We're retrenched in our blackness. And to leave the space is to like give up territory that we fought so hard to keep, right? And so we sort of forget the past and all of the stuff that just was perfectly normal. We weren't segregated on radio. We weren't segregated musically and in terms of the ambitions of certain artists. And there was a big pool of people doing a lot of interesting things all at the same time on different records in the same moment. And I feel like the weird thing now is we're also self-conscious about being black. One of the things about this, about Beyoncé for me, is that there's a conscious black retention.
And conservatism?
I wouldn't, no, because I actually think Lemonade musically is doing a lot of different things in a classical way.
Right, but I mean like
black pop artist way.
But I mean not about the actual music, but about the positioning or about the narrative.
I don't think it's conservatism. I think it's necessity. I think the Harry Belafonte gauntlet throwdown, or like, please continue this legacy that I fought very hard to give to you. Please take it. I don't care what you do with it, but acknowledge that I'm giving it to you, whatever that means. She to me is a powerful version of the moment that we're in, but also just a great artist on a continuum of open-minded artistry.
I think what it is it's a lot of sort of reactionary defensiveness. Like there's a
right,
lot
I mean,
of
this
stupidity,
is...
you know, in the culture right now, especially this year with the guy who's running for president. And so we feel like when we see these terrible, like, you know, pictures of Kylie Jenner or something with, like, cornrows, and they're like, look, like, hot new hairdo. Stuff like that makes us be like, all right, well, this record just came out, and what you're not going to do, you know, is, like, take this. And so the conversation around Frank being R&B specifically is kind of like...
We have to
an extension
it.
Of that, yeah.
Right. When, it's a claiming.
When it was never, like, a situation where... We could make more music than just R&B always, is, I guess, the point. But just people don't feel like...
But it's interesting because even Frank himself, like, you look in... I mean, you listen to, you know, there's a Trayvon reference on Nikes, but then also if you read the interviews and the discussions that are in the magazine, I wouldn't say he's outright rejecting some of that conversation, but he sees himself inside it and outside that conversation. And... It's strange.
As we a lot of us do.
Right.
I mean,
which is totally normal.
For yeah. In their, like, 20s. Yeah.
But it's, which is why it's so strange to see that reductive discourse of kind of like you're in or you're out. No pun intended. But
wordplay.
On that note, maybe let's go out with Good Guy and then let's all give Frank Ocean a hug afterwards.
Frank.
It's our good guy. He lift it up. If I was in NY, I should look you up. First time I ever saw you. And you text nothing like you look.
Thanks for listening to the New York Times podcast. Thank you to my guests, Justin Charity, Craig Jenkins, Wesley Morris, and Jenna Wortham. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcasts. Read what all of us have had to say about Frank Ocean at nytimes.com/music. Download us and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, anywhere you get your podcast content. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and we will be back next week.
No, you don't need me right now. And to you, it's just late.